You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Welcome to Monday's episode of the Perth Scottish Football Podcast. My name is Craig Cairns, and you don't know anything about little Dominique's nosebleed. Joining me to go through the weekend's Premiership matches, expect some Simpsons references, it's Tom Watt.
Yes, indeed. I was going to give a Simpsons reference, but I can't think of anyone. Expect some Simpsons references at a future time when I can think of one that's apt. Hello.
And straight up gangster rap, it's Joel Sked.
Hello, don't expect any Simpsons references from me.
Or gangster rap.
Or gangster rap, no, that's certainly not in my genre or wheelhouse. Just before we before we crack on, Craig, are we recording?
Yeah. Oh, okay. I do it through the soundboard, not Zoom.
Ah, okay. Sorry, listeners, but I was just wanting to double check before we cracked on further.
Say something incredibly controversial.
Just to test it. Anyway, yeah, so we're going to go through the weekend's matches, but we're going to start with some relatively breaking news, I suppose, is this afternoon, another Celtic player tested positive for coronavirus. That's not really the news. What we want to talk about is Celtic manager Neil Lennon's reaction to it all and his press conference. The now mellowed Neil Lennon looked like he stormed out at the end of it. There's a clip online where he says, like, we haven't broken any rules. He talks about this hypocrisy, and it looks like he stands up to leave. I don't know whether that was maybe the last question or whether he stormed out, but I heard an extended version of it on BBC there just recently, and it was Kerry Dinitsa, and you could hear how I'd be the same in that position, by the way, but you could hear how kind of, I don't want to say the word scared, but he was kind of cowering a wee bit from Lennon. But like I say, I would be exactly the same if that was me. But yeah, we'll start with you, Tom. What did you make of that press conference?
Remarkable, just absolutely remarkable. I mean, you thought it couldn't really get worse, and you thought that perhaps, like when Peter Lawwell came out and said, I mean, it wasn't quite the full and frank apology and mea culpa that people might have expected, but at least it was a step in the right direction. You expected that maybe that was, you know, that was the start of the end of it. But oh no, the new, more mellow Neil turns up full air quotes, full, you know, saying things like the whole squad is fine other than the two that, you know, other than the two that test the problem. Yeah, I mean, the whole of the 20th century was peaceful apart from the two world wars. it was absolutely remarkable. Like, he is livid throughout. Everyone, like, you know, taking bodies, just claiming the government are out to get them. There's hypocrisy all over the place. I mean, saying that it wasn't for Peter Lowell to apologise, it should have been an apology from him, but then not apologising.
That's
remarkable.
It wasn't going to be an easy press conference, but he could have made it a hell of a lot easier by just going, we just want to move on now. Peter Lowell came out and said sorry, we agree. Well, basically, just reiterate what Peter Lowell has said. Even Peter Lowell's apology was like 30 seconds of apology and 4 minutes of pish. And then, that was brilliant compared to what Lennon then produced. And you just listen to Lennon and think, are you actually saying these words? I don't... It's football managers, I don't know, they're not as bad as politicians, but why can't people just front up and apologise for stuff? Yep, we've made a cunt of it. Looking back, in hindsight, we're probably in the wrong. We apologise, we like to move on. But it was just bamboozling listening to him. And then I just listened to a clip that I hadn't seen earlier, just before we came on, and he was talking about... He was talking about being an agenda against Celtic and the politics are being at play, and as if he disagreed with the COVID rules and the fact that he says no one at Celtic's got COVID, but they've had two positive tests. So from my reckoning, positive tests indicate that players do have coronavirus, which is... I'm just lost for words with what Lennon said.
Second one could be not related to the Dubai trip whatsoever. We don't really know the details of the second one. I mean, it likely isn't related to the Dubai trip if it's only coming out now.
I just think I don't know why there's this defensive attitude to it. Like previously, you know, Celtic are very well known for coming out with strong statements. Like any time there's any kind of criticism of their behaviour or the way that they've acted, and largely it makes an awful lot of sense because it does kind of circle the wagons, and their supporters largely buy into whatever the party line is. The biggest critic of Celtic's attitude in the last, you know, the last 3 or 4 weeks have been Celtic fans. It's like the people who, I mean, in many ways it's not funny because there are 100,000 people that have died from coronavirus in the UK because it's a killer disease and because that's the reason that we're all staying at home. But the people that are like sort of writing this off as with kind of incredulity are fans of everyone else. The people that are angry are the Celtic supporters who have paid for games that they're never going to see, been shut out of a stadium that they're not going to go to this season, not been allowed within touching distance of the stadium this season, had some horrendous results, you know, asked for a change in leadership that they're not going to get, and then they've seen pictures of the squad flying halfway around the world enjoying themselves after a second Old Firm defeat of the season. The people that are angry about this are their own support. Do you owe them to front up and say, yeah, at least the optics were bad, you know, at least saying, yeah, maybe some of the decisions that were made would have been done differently, to suggest that it's like people out to get them or anything like that? It is baffling. Well, I don't know which crowd they're playing to this time.
Yeah, you're right, because there are a few that are still kind of sticking up for them through thick and thin, but you're right, there's like, you just don't see many Celtic fans coming out and defending, no matter where you look at the moment. I mean, you're limited. We don't have supporters in pubs and in stadiums and things like that, but no matter where you look at the moment, there's criticism. Wherever you listen or look, there's criticism. And that goes all the way to some of the very, very Celtic-minded pundits that we have as well. Andy Walker at the weekend. I mean, I'm not saying that these guys are usually biased or anything like that. Sometimes they are, yes. But, like, even these guys have turned on them all. Yeah, so you're totally right, Tom. I mean, who are they actually playing to here? Have we got anything else to add in this before we move on to the weekend's matches?
Just on the first thing you said about Kerry Dean, asking Neil Lennon questions. I'd be exact same. I'd be shitting myself. But the thing is, though, you couldn't diffuse it with a straight up, how's the squad looking for Wednesday? Because that opens a whole new can of worms, because they've all been there. I've been in a not a similar position, but Andy Halliday didn't scold me, but accused me of putting words in his mouth once, and then I just shirked and went into a cage.
Yeah, exactly. That's it. And then it's just like there's one kind of wee thing that causes that, and then you've just got to get your way through the rest of it. Yeah, I totally felt for him there, yeah. But anyway, we'll move on to the weekend's matches, and then we'll start with the eye-popping result of Ross County 4, Aberdeen 1. We'll come to Aberdeen in a bit, but that's 3 in his last 4 for Ollie Shaw now. And we saw Jermaine Hilton on the score sheet as well, and also it looked like that Regan Charles Cook caused a few problems as well. This kind of, they seemed to go very brave with like a front three up against the back three of Aberdeen, and they caused them problems right from the off.
Yeah, so Ross County, looking at them as a whole, it's hard to analyse the start of the game with Ross County without mentioning Aberdeen, because Aberdeen were abhorrent, to put it frankly. Ross County, as soon as they went kind of 1-2, as soon as they went 2-0 up, it was a case of that they were, I think, quite happy to have Aberdeen, little Aberdeen have the ball, and they were breaking on them. Again, that opens up with Jermaine Hilton and Regan Charles Cook, that they have that pace to get up the pitch. Ollie Shaw, I'm still not sold on him, to be honest. That two fantastic goals. The second one in particular I really enjoyed. Just his body movement, the way he turned it back towards goal, and I think it was very crafty what he did. But as a striker overall, I think he is a good finisher, but I just wouldn't trust him as a focal point. But as long as you can create chances and have someone like that, he's going to score goals. I did see over the weekend that I think it was Arab Analytics put up that he didn't watch the game. He just looked at the chances, did the expected goals thing, and mentioned that Ross County were perhaps fortunate to win. I would not go anywhere near as far as that. But Ross Laidlaw had to have a very good game. As bad as Aberdeen were, they still created chances, and Ross Laidlaw's probably the best game I've seen him play. But overall, County did look a lot more solid, and it's quite something considering they've had to make changes to their backline.
So Aberdeen have had some success out of this 3-4-3 system earlier in the season, Tom. He's kind of stuck with it a bit through the poor results recently, but there's been signs in the last couple of matches that when he's moved to a back four, they've improved. Against Rangers, also after this game, after going 2-0 down in this game, went to a back four and they looked better. They created lots of chances between then and half time. It was too late.
Yeah, it's a strange one. I mean, the game in general was a very strange one, because like you said, it was pretty much done after 20 minutes because of the start Aberdeen made. Very weird game though, because had it not as bad as Aberdeen were, they could easily have been 4-2 up. Were it not for a combination of some horrendous finishing, which is what I'll come on to, and Laidlaw had a very, very good game. The biggest problem with the three at the back, with the personnel that are currently available, is they can't get anything like a functioning front line. They started here with Cosgrove and Main, who do not work together. I mean, there is no need to have that. And I mean, the most telling statistic from it was there were 31 crosses into the box. The only one that ended up in the net was probably an own goal. I mean, some people have got it as Curtis Main, but you know, 31 crosses into the box with two guys that are target men, and you're not getting anything more out of it than that. And yes, there have been injury problems. You know, Greg Lee was out, McGeoch was out, Devlin was out, Watkins is out until next month and back down south. But the starting lineup should be better than that. Should start, should be switched on, because so much of the goals were all, the damage was so much self-inflicted.
If there's any reasoning behind it you can think, Tom, why was Johnny Hayes playing on the right and Matty Kennedy playing on the left? Because you see it with first two goals, Hayes so far up the pitch, and even just an attacking wise, they're cutting in. One of the best chances Aberdeen created was when Hayes was actually on the left-hand side despite playing on the right-hand side. It just struck me as McInnes again trying to be too smart for his own good.
Yeah, I mean, I can only assume the thinking is you're going to get them in support of the of two main strikers rather than try, like, with two guys like that, what you want to do is get high balls into the box, especially who they're up against from Ross County. You want high balls into the box. They didn't do that. They were cutting inside, and it, like you say, it just it does seem to be overthinking it.
Because I think he was up against Randall. Randall's right footed, so he's going to cut in onto Randall's stronger foot. When you play Kennedy on that side, he's just going to go down. He can just go down the outside and cross for two guys who are sometimes good in there.
Yeah, I think that the biggest problem in this was overthinking it. I think when they went to a system, you know, that was more like the play last season, I still think that the three at the back is probably the way to go in future. But you need to have the you need to have a different setup up front. Like they desperately missed Hedges. Wright was the only one that was creating anything, and you can't really rely on Main and Cosgrove if you those are your two main focal points. You do need someone that's going to run. I mean, Niall McGinn might be a waning power, but he'd probably be a better fit as one of your front three than either Main or Cosgrove. But that result was coming. That result was coming. The way that they've played in the last five or six games, where they've had a lot of possession, not been able to convert chances when there have been some. I don't think I'm doing Ross County any discredit that they did give up a lot of chances. But Aberdeen don't look like scoring when they've got the ball on the edge of the box. If you can sit back and stop them getting, if you can stop them working it through the middle, the crosses from out wide aren't really causing any problems. And things do feel stale at the moment. They do. The positivity from November, when Hedges and Wright were flying and the midfield looked like a solved problem, and all the noises were that Wright would sign a new contract. Now it looks like they'll end January weaker than they started it. There are a lot of frustrations from the fans.
So, Joel, are you still not sure about Ross County in general, or is it just Otley Shaw?
Not sure about Ross County in general, to be honest. There's obviously positive signs over the last few weeks. I was really impressed with them against Hibs. So there is signs that they're better organised than they were under Kettlewell. Defensively, it was funny. The first thing I thought of when I seen the first two goals Aberdeen conceded was that was very Ross County-esque defending from last season and sometimes this season. He's getting a bit more out of Payton. Payton does seem like a player who I think Hughes would like a lot. I accused Payton of being kind of Jason Holt-like when he was at Hearts, where he had all these technical qualities and he's a quite intelligent player, but he didn't put really, as for an attacking midfielder, didn't put like the numbers on the board. But he's scoring goals, he's creating assists now. Jermaine Hilton adds a bit more dynamism to the team. He is someone who will have a game like that and then he'll be quiet for three or four, but down at the bottom, that's sometimes all you need. The work in progress is Ross County. I think they'll probably do a bit more business, but I've seen enough of a lot of the players that play for them that I'm not fully trusting of them to be certain of escaping relegation.
Aye. And it's still very, very tight down there. So, I mean, it's like it's not like one team's cut adrift or anything like that and they're in that position where they have to get out. I mean, it could be one of six teams or something like that at the moment. Right, we'll move on to the next game. And that was a live game from Sunday. And it was Motherwell 1, Rangers 1. Graham Alexander, new Motherwell manager. That's the same result in his first two matches, I think, isn't it? And quite similar in that they've done well in the first half and then maybe dropped off a bit in the second half. It seemed, I was really surprised by how Motherwell approached this game. We'll stick with you, Joel. But I was really surprised at how Motherwell approached this game. It looked like the personnel in the formation looked like it could have been a Robinson team. I know that they've got two things that Robinson didn't have in the last little while, and that's a goalkeeper and a left back. But other than that, it really looked like a Robinson team, right down to the kind of interchange in front three. The big difference was that they were trying to pass out from the back, just like Rangers were. But they're two centre halves in the either side of the 6-yard box when they've got goal kicks and all that kind of jazz. What did you think of their approach?
Yeah, that was a big thing for me, especially because Bevis Mugabe is someone who, if I was setting up a team, depending on how you how you want the team to play. He's someone you either have the ball, so it allows you to get organised, because you know that he, when you shut off a lot of passing options, he doesn't really know what to do with it, and he's ending going to send it long. Or if you are a team who are looking to press high up the pitch, he is someone I'd be looking to try and get Motherwell to funnel the ball to and then press him, because I think he's very, very panicky. So that aspect of it was surprising. But I think the more positive, I think the thing Motherwell fans perhaps should be even more positive was how proactive Motherwell were at trying to stop Rangers from playing from the back. Seen on Twitter when someone compared it to the previous game at Fir Park between the two sides, and I think Motherwell were quite standoffish. This time they weren't. They stopped, tried to stop Rangers from playing it from the back, and success. First half especially, I thought they were absolutely fantastic, and the goal itself really summed up how positive they've been. It was just such a patient, well worked goal. And big fan of Tony Watt's movement, because, like I said, it's an interchange in front three, so he played central. The ball went left to Carroll. He could have waited for a crossing, or he could have went short to try and get the ball, but he just took Goldson right out wide, and then that left a massive gap to then play. Goldson came back in, and it just caused confusion, and I think that's what Alexander will want a bit more from his front three. That's what you want from a front three who are capable of interchanging, confusing the opposition defence.
What did you make of Motherwell's performance, Tom?
Yeah, I think the big difference, I mean, Graham Alexander looking very much the deputy head of modern studies, who sometimes sails a bit close to the wind on the sideline. I think I think the big difference between it was they seemed confident. The big thing I've got written underneath is confident and patient. They didn't try and force it. They were pressing Rangers, and I think understandably Rangers have their performance has slightly dropped off in recent weeks from where they were, but Motherwell were very good at pressing them, like Joel says, but the big thing was the patience when they had the ball. They weren't trying to force anything. I think to some extent Rangers played to their strengths quite a lot with the diagonal balls over the top. Diagonal balls to the back post do slightly play into Motherwell's hands when you've got McGavie and Gallagher, who were able to be quite dogged and sit deep and get rid of those. But I think the difference, I mean, it may just be the difference that when you've got a left back and a goalkeeper that you know you can rely on, but there seemed to be a lot more assuredness, there seemed to be a lot more confidence, and there seemed to be a patience to it that they would find. Like, if you've got an interchangeable front three, there's not always going to be a killer pass to play. There's not always going to be a target man to hit. There's not always going to be somebody, you know, you're not going to necessarily be able to do something in a couple of moves. So being patient and waiting for the angles to happen and waiting for somebody to pull someone out of it, that's kind of the name of the game. That worked very well with the front three. They understandably dropped an awful lot deeper in the second half. And they did have to play a little bit more with their backs to the wall. But I think the difference between even 2 or 3 weeks ago, when I would have said they were the worst team in the league, not in personnel, but in the way that they were playing and the confidence that they had and the confidence that you had that they might get pick up points in any given week, they certainly don't look that like that anymore. And, you know, I would expect them to pull away.
And Rangers, I mean, I don't think there's too much to say about Rangers, to be honest. I think it was just that they just had a bit of an off day for the first 45 minutes, and they could play that exact game again and still come away. I think they created enough to win the game, really. I think on another day they win that game, even though they go behind in it. I think we have been witnessing, or are in the middle of witnessing, Rangers' slump. I think this is it. I mean, I don't think they're going to... I'm not necessarily saying they're going to go the whole league season unbeaten, but I think anybody hoping that Rangers are going to drop some points and go on a wee kind of run of not winning a game for 2 or 3 matches or whatever, I just don't think it's happening. I think we're watching their slump just now and they're still picking up results. Anybody disagree with that?
No, I was going to say wait till they get back into Europe, see if that has an effect. But you actually look back to the start of the season when they were playing Europe, so they're playing Thursday, Friday. They just found this stride, this momentum that even though Gerrard make changes, they would win games and especially in Europe, play really, really well. And then since Europe's kind of stopped, that's where the stagnated kind of hit a level where they've gone down a level, not hit the level of early in the season. So
I think have worked them out slightly a wee bit as well. I think some teams have found a way to exploit the space in behind the fullbacks and to nullify them a bit more. You've seen that happen in more games recently, and that's just what happens if you have if you can't just have a successful formation that works forever. Like, it gets figured out and you have to kind of adapt it, and I think we're just in the process of them adapting it, to be honest. Sorry to cut across you there, but
no and yeah, it's a very good point, because you look at it, the fact that Scott Arfield's obviously been out for a few weeks now, Ryan Jack's been out for a few weeks, so those two that he's affected, Gerrard's effectively haven't played Davis, Aribo and Kamara each week, and that gain kind of falls into the predictability. So before, opposition managers weren't sure how the Rangers midfield, what the look up, how it would look.
I think that's fair. And I think the other factor that is probably at play is they're 20 odd points ahead. Like, there may be, you know, you don't have the we need to win every single week. You don't have the, like, they can afford to pace themselves a bit. They can, and I don't necessarily think that was, that comes into thinking or accounts for the way that they played here, because I think they were just flat. Like, they had a lot of chances that they didn't take. Aribo was poor. Ryan Kent was running back towards his own goal a lot. Barisic, who for the first 4 months of the season was arguably the standout player in the league, has gone off the boil a wee bit and certainly isn't producing the same attacking threat. But I think that all of that, like, partly, as you say, it's inevitable there'll be a lull, and I wouldn't be surprised if they drop more points in the coming weeks. But, you know, they're still picking up points most weeks. But the other thing is, I there isn't anyone breathing down their necks. I think in any given week, you would still bet on Celtic dropping points more than Rangers would.
The big thing is that essentially Rangers are playing without any pressure. The league's done and dusted. And before there was positive pressure, so they knew that they just needed to keep winning and just continue opening that gap ahead of Celtic. Now the gap is so big that subconsciously they're just going to relax almost, and then that kind of drop in intensity at a tempo, and that's just natural.
Yeah, Celtic just no bothering playing games and stuff. Just like, just increase that lead. Just go play again and just get even further ahead of us. Give us more of a psychological gap to kind of get over to. Anyway, right, let's move on to the next game. We'll go Easter Road, where Hibs beat Kilmarnock 2-0. This was a pretty uneventful first 45 minutes in this one, it seemed. But there were a couple of debuts for Jackson Irvine and Chris Cadden. These guys seem to be, again, the right kind of signings for Hibs. They are in areas where they kind of need a bit of competition and or cover, because I don't know, I feel like a lot of the time this season I've looked at Hibs's bench and there's just been absolutely nothing on it, and these guys kind of pad out a little bit.
Yeah, they've going back to last season, Hibs have had quite a small squad. That there's not been a lot of options, but they've had the good things that Hibs have had, or the managers have possessed, is players who can play in a variety of positions. And again, that's Irvine does that to an extent. He can play in different midfield positions, whereas Cadden is very much a utility man, and he's probably the one I'm more intrigued to see. Irvine is, obviously, we were a massive fan of him at the podcast when he was at Ross County. It was sad to see him go. Intriguingly, that he's only signed a deal until the end of the season, so I don't know if this is kind of just a play and then kind of see what happens, or he's thinking just get some games on the belt and then look to go back down to England. For Cadden, he signed a 2.5-year deal. The whole Oxford Columbus thing is a strange one, because he's not really settled either of those. Now he's got a chance to settle at Hibs, and I just want to see him settle in a position. I think that's the big thing that Cadden has, and I hope that he's, when he's went in, he's talked to Jack Ross and goes, basically, I want a position that I can play in week out, get week in, week out, get consistency in that position and learn and improve in that position. Because I think towards the end of his Motherwell spell, the just didn't hit the heights of previously, just because I think he was moved around a bit. So that one's a big one for me.
Do you think that position is going to be right wing back? That's where I see him playing for Hibs, at least to begin with, because like kind of Dre Wright's been played there recently. I think they're maybe looking for reasons not to play Martin Boyle there. I don't think, obviously, John McGinn isn't a wing back. He can play right back and he can get up and down a bit. Paul McGinn, but he's not a wing back. I'm not the first or the last to make that mistake. And maybe they're looking to use Boyle more just as a, like, to have three quality strikers to choose from, rather than using Boyle as a more of a utility player. I don't know. That was my thinking when I saw the Cadden signing.
I believe Cadden might have came to Hibs with the thought of playing as a right back or wing back with Scotland in mind.
There you go.
That would possibly make a lot of sense.
Smart thinking.
That would make a lot of sense. I mean, that's got to be an incentive for him. I mean, it's. There's not huge competition there, and if you're playing for your club in that wing back in a wing back role, we don't have any right backs that play regularly for their club, you know, week in, week out, in that kind of, in a similar system to the way that it might with Scotland. So that would be an interesting development for him. I think they're both very good signings. I think they're both as safe signings as you can make without them being boring. You know, they've performed up here before. They're both at a good age. They've both got a lot of football left in them. They've both played at a relatively high level, and I think they do add something that Hibs don't have already. I mean, I don't think it's. I think this game kind of, Irvine had a couple of, you know, was involved in a couple of things. I think largely the game kind of passed him by, but that's not that surprising given that he's not played much football in the last 8 months, and Cadden only came on late. But they both offer something that they don't have. I think in theory that Hibs midfield looks an awful lot more dynamic with him in it, with any other two of their central players. And you know, like Joel said, Irvine in this, he certainly started quite far forward, but he could easily play, you know, he could play a more holding role. He could be a box-to-box player, depending on how Hibs want to set up. So I think two very intriguing, very, very good signings.
It's going back to what you asked, Craig, about the... you mentioned about Hibs having a small squad. These two players allow Hibs to play so many different systems and formations. They can fit in 4-3-3, 3-5-2. These players can fill in gaps depending on what Ross wants to play, and it gives Hibs so much flexibility. Again, I am slightly jealous. I would have taken both at Hearts because they are the Premiership players who are, as Tom said, used to proven at Premiership level, but they have the physicality and temperament to succeed in Scotland.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Yeah, I'm not sure you're getting ahead of Mikey Smith Cadden right enough, but yeah, I'd still take him.
No, not as a right back.
So Kilmarnock, let's talk about them for a wee bit. You'll notice we're not talking about much to do with this game. It was a pretty drab match for according to all reports. But Kilmarnock, I know they're sitting. They had a wee bit of a kind of spell recently, and they're sitting about mid-table at the moment. But looking at all those kind of teams in the bottom half, they are one of the ones I still worry about the most. Even though they're, like I say, even though they're kind of sitting mid-table at the moment, I just think that the squad just seems to be lacking in so many key areas, and I don't know. They seem to have. I'm trying to pick my words quite nicely here, but they seem to be lacking a wee bit in the manager front as well. He seems to be one of the weaker managers in the league. Is that fair? Is that unfair?
I think the worry for Killie is like, or the worry for everybody down there, should you be more worried about the teams that we know are not very good but occasionally are picking up points, because there seems to be a few of those, or should you be worried about the teams that are actually playing reasonably well and have quite a few, you know, game-changing players in it but are not picking up points? And I think Kilmarnock fall into that category. I think they don't tend to change games. If they go behind, you're fairly certain that they're done. I think that they were unlucky in this game to some extent, because I think when Kabamba came on and Burke came on, they did look a lot more bright, and you know, Kabamba hit the post.
He was really unlucky. And
there wasn't an awful lot in terms of quality between the two teams. I just think Hibs played the conditions an awful lot better. You know, the pitch wasn't in great condition. The ball was getting stuck under players' feet an awful lot, and they were struggling to keep balance a bit. The game was played in the air an awful lot more than either team would want, and I think Hibs just adapted to that a lot better. But I think my worry for Kilmarnock is if you can't, but they go to this, it's the same go-to players, and if they get injured or they don't turn up for a couple of weeks or anything like that, they don't seem to be able to change the way that a game's going, the momentum of a game, and I think that's a concern for them.
Joel, do you have anything to add on Kilmarnock before we move on?
No, I think Tom hit the nail on the head about the same players. They're going to the well time and time again with the same players who have to get them out, like Chris Burke. It needs freshened up at Killy. The signings in the summer haven't done that. I think obviously you mentioned about Alex Dyer. There's a lot of reservations amongst Killy fans about Dyer. So I think at the moment Killy fans would happily take consolidation and then start again, maybe start fresh in the summer with a rebuild, because there's a lot of players who are getting on in age. But just before we move on, back on the Hibs side, I think word of praise for Gogic and especially Josh Doig, who had perhaps his best game in a Hibs shirt.
Yeah, he looked excellent.
But his Gogic goal was fantastic.
Yeah, so we'll move on to the next match. The last match that we're going to talk about with a goal, and it was a solitary one. That's St Johnstone 1, St Mirren 0. It was a repeat of the scoreline in this fixture earlier in the season. I think that's St Johnstone still unbeaten in this year so far, isn't it? But it was their first league win since November. They got the goal through Chris Kane, who tried his best to miss both opportunities, I think. I think the first one, I mean, he's caught it quite well, but it's really close to Anik. But then the second one, the one he actually scores from, it's like he's got the whole right-hand side of the goal to shoot at, but he decides to put it in the bottom left-hand corner where Anik is, and he almost fucks it up. But then Melamed, sorry, he was involved in the build-up, and they look like he'd scored in the Dundee United game, I think, after coming in to start, and they look like they're doing okay together. But what about should the goal have stood? Was there a handball in the build-up?
No.
No, this Stephen McLean. So I watched at the time, I was thinking, that's a handball. You can see, obviously, Shaughnessy stops, looks at McLean. I know you should play the whistle, but Shaughnessy stops, looks at McLean. And then when the move carries on, so Melmed sets up Kane, Shaughnessy gets back and he just about blocks it. So that kind of, that second or two where he stops and looks at McLean affects what happens next. And then you see with Anik charging out at McLean. So the rules are, if the ball hits your hand and your hand or arm is above head height or shoulder height, then it's automatically a foul. Only exception is if it hits, if you hit it. So if it deflects off, for example, if it hit his head and then hit his arm, I don't think that's a foul. It didn't. It hit Shaughnessy headed onto Melamed's hand. McLean was in a perfect position. It was a very poor decision.
It is like one of those ones, I think, and I think Goodwin alluded to this, but it's one of those ones that referees seem to, like, they can't wait to give these ones in the box at the moment. Yeah, this one was clear as day right in front of the referee, and he somehow missed it. It was a weird one.
If Shaughnessy had headed it slightly less hard, I think it would, like, because he gets a really good head on it, like, it doesn't change the direction of the ball. That's the only thing I could think. But, like, the microphones in the on the TV coverage pick up the sound of it hitting his hand. So quite surprised it stood. But I mean, there's still a little bit to do, and yes, St Mirren could have been a bit more switched on. But yeah, definitely a handball shouldn't have stood, and not the only decision that went against St Mirren.
What are you thinking of the red card?
I am indeed. The red card, which I thought was very harsh.
Oh, this one for me, I can see why McLean is given both yellow cards. The first one, he's kind of looking like straight at it, where McPherson kind of does a sweep with his right foot, so he kind of makes a tackle and follows through on Melamed. And then the breakaway, I think there had to be a bit more a bit more sensibility from McPherson. He was diving in from the wrong side. He may have got a touch, but again, McLean's positioning, it looks bad from McLean's position.
I agree with what you're saying, and I think the first one was definitely a yellow card. You know, he's late, he's not in control. It's not like a nasty challenge, but fair enough, it's a yellow, he catches the trailing leg. The second one, I think, is really harsh. I can see why the referee sees it not just as being late, but also stopping a breakaway. And I can see why he's given it. But even watch it slowed down. He doesn't dive in aggressively. I don't think there's any contact with the man. I think he wins the ball quite cleanly. He doesn't leave the ground. He doesn't show his studs. I can see why it was given, because in real time you can see it might have looked, the referee was slightly blindsided in it, but watching it back, I don't think he plays the man. I don't think he goes in dangerously. I don't think he goes in aggressively. I don't think there's any danger to it. I think he wins the ball and doesn't make any contact with the man whatsoever. I think I can't remember who the challenge was on, but I think if he hadn't gone Melamed, over quite
so, again, I think
it was a Melamed. If he hadn't gone over quite so theatrically, I think it would have been not that he dived to get it, but I think that made it look an awful lot worse than it actually was, and I don't want to see that go out of the game.
So have St Mirren improved here to kind of get this result? It seems that, sorry, not St Mirren, St Johnstone, have they improved for this match to get this result? Because it seems to me, or it feels like to me, my perception of St Johnstone at sometimes has been that they've played to the same ability just about every match this season. It's just the results have varied within them. Like, they'll always kind of be set up really well, they'll have a good shape about them, they'll always create some chances. It's just hit or miss whether they score some of those chances or not.
I thought that was one of their poorer performances. I watched this game today, and I watched the Dundee United game through the week, and I thought they played better against Dundee United, and I'm sure a lot of Saints fans would probably come and say they've played better this season and not got the 3 points. They did deserve the 3 points. We're about to talk about two 0-0 games, but this may as well be a 0-0 game, because it was really, really poor. It was not a lot happened, but St Johnstone had the difference. Wotherspoon, for me, sometimes fades out a game too quickly, but he was very bright in the first half. You talked about Chris Kane. He reminds him and Scott Robinson are Livy. They're just two pests. They run all day. They are decent. There's some decent in the air for their size. They're quite smart at the way they jump or back into defenders. Melamed and Kane do look like they're striking up a half-decent partnership. I think Melamed is still getting used to the tempo of the game. Sometimes he just needs to do what he does a wee bit quicker. But they were defensively sound. St Mirren never looked like they were going to break down St Johnstone. They actually probably played a little bit better once they went down to 10 men, but St Johnstone just defended so well that St Mirren just couldn't get going to the final third, and then they just didn't do anything. They just couldn't stretch. They just didn't or couldn't stretch the game in behind, and it was everything just stopped when it went into the St Johnstone defensive third.
Right, as you kind of mentioned, Joel, we're going to speak about two 0-0s now, or we're going to do our best. We'll start with the Celtic 0 Livingston 0 match. That was I find it quite interesting what Bartley said on Sports Scene yesterday, how their game plan was to force them inside and press them from there, because they knew that he didn't really have a striker or anything. But he didn't say this, but this is what I took from it, because they didn't really have any kind of central threat in attacking areas, that the plan was to kind of force them into central areas rather than out wide where they could hurt them. But yeah, it looked like it just looked like another out of sorts performance from Celtic. Duffy was all over the place. Laxalt looked really, really poor. I know that they could have maybe taken the lead with a couple of chances early on, Celtic, but Livingston had the better chances of that after.
I think it almost played out like if you didn't know who the players were and you didn't know who the teams were, it almost played out like a well-contested Celtic European game where they were under the cosh for large parts of it, could have snatched a win. But the fact is, it's a game against Livingston who, you know, as good as they have been, totally imposed their style on them. I mean, and Strachan, Gavin Strachan, the undefeated, sorry, Celtic PR machine, the undefeated Gavin Strachan admitted that Livy had kind of imposed their style on Celtic. And that's kind of remarkable. I mean, yes, they were missing an awful lot of players, and you would not, you know, a back four of Ralston, Beaton, Duffy and Laxalt is kind of going to give anyone the fear, and starting with Tom Rogic up front, it's obviously a side that's very much a shadow of what they might be. But the way that Livingston kind of imposed their style and they were creating havoc, and I think it is quite telling that, you know, obviously Livingston will be happy enough that they got a point, but they were saying afterwards it's a sign of how high their confidence is, how low Celtic's confidence is, and how much that they actually got from the game, where especially in the first sort of 10-15 minutes they were absolutely ragdolling them, that they were disappointed they didn't win.
Celtic fans didn't seem as happy with Ralston for his crunching challenge this time.
That was a straight red. I mean, when I seen that challenge, I thought back to two incidents early under Brendan Rodgers. I think it was Ryan Bowman on Kieran Tierney, maybe, and also I think it was it Jaden Stockley on Kieran Tierney. Like Celtic fans up in arms about the roughness of opposition teams, but that's what Ralston is. You hear that. You hear that phrase like, oh, he's not that type of player. Ralston is very much that type of player who does that type of challenge. And he just, when he started, you kind of just knew this. All of the things that has happened at Celtic this season, that might be the lowest point, is that they've had to start Ralston, because that back four, that defence, the most expensive bottom six Premiership defence I've ever seen. Bottom six standard, just to say. Bottom six standard.
No, I got what you meant. Yeah. Have we much to say about Livy? I mean, they look like they acquitted themselves really well. They've just carried on their excellent form and performances off the back of eight wins. And the chances they had, I mean, Robinson, I can understand with the goal scoring form he's in where he takes that, but he's got to slip in Mullen, was it? Yeah. And then the Ambrose header, that's unforgivable, really. So yeah, even though Celtic kind of had their chances either side of Livy's ones, it looked like Livy really had the best ones to win the game.
I was so impressed once the game with Livingston. I mentioned on last week's podcast, I've not really watched them too much under Martindale until the last couple of weeks, and so impressed. You can see Martindale is for all his past is a very, very good football coach. I think he's a very switched on football coach. I think he's got his kind of finger on the pulse, because you see him on the sidelines. He is constantly cajoling and tinkering and advising. I think he's just got a very good football brain, and that's come across in how well Livingston played, how they approached the game, the way they pressed. Is that it just seems any time the ball went in, into a Celtic player who was facing his own goal, that's the moment that they press and they try to win the ball back. I said it, I can't remember if I said it before, I think it might have been on the WhatsApp group, is the fact that Celtic, that Livingston, probably the team they did not want to face aside from Rangers, because that squad of players just knew Livingston were just going to make it so uncomfortable for them.
Now they've got them again. We don't know exactly who's missing from the Celtic team, and it's on that pitch that they absolutely fucking hate playing on. Bring it on. I think Celtic are going to win. I think Celtic are going to win this one, to be honest. I think I think with the semi-final coming up and that kind of thing, I think Livy, I don't think Livy players will be pulling out challenges or anything like that, but I think they'll be like a not wanting to be burnt out or injured going into the, and it's short of any kind of fitness going into the semi-final. So I don't know. I fancy Celtic to win that game, but that's not what we're here to talk about. Shall we move on to the last game and get the fuck out of here?
The worst game of the weekend.
It was just Hamilton 0, Dundee United 0, but it had that Ryan Fulton save, which was pretty damn good.
It was a very, very good save. United had quite a lot of the ball without doing a huge amount, which has kind of been the story of their season. But Ryan Fulton makes a very, very good save from Ian Harkes. Hamilton seemed to have the better of the chances. I am basing this on the highlights because although I watched as much as I could of all the other games, I'm at a loose end during lockdown. I will like regrout the bathroom before I wisecout Hamilton 0 Dundee United 0 from this season. I do not enjoy watching Dundee United this season. I've said that on the record. It's not sour grapes. I just don't understand why with what they do have, and they've got more than most, and the points tally that they have on the board where they are pretty much safe, they can't show a little bit more ambition. I mean, I was joking with friends the other week that the one of the reasons Lauren Shanklin scored from the halfway line the other week is because it's the first time anyone's given him the ball facing the goal since September. And I think that was almost the case again. Like, yes, they could have won, and Fulton's save is a really, really good save to get that up and over the bar. Yes, it is close to him, but the reactions to get that up and over the bar and not just to scoop it into his own net was an excellent save. But it seemed like it was Hamilton that were doing all the probing, were doing all the pushing. Their midfield gives them an awful lot of energy when they push on. There's not a huge amount of quality in that midfield, but the midfield support the front line well, and they were creating chances. They did have opportunities, and there was an awful lot of last ditch. And Dundee United's defence has been the one very good thing about them this season, where they've been very, very solid. They looked a bit more panicky from what I took from this.
Are Dundee United just all right, Joel? Are they just like many of the? Earlier in the season, I wasn't sure whether they were good or not. There was this kind of debate whether Dundee United are any good or not. But are they just all right? Is that just the situation that they've come up and they're just all right? They're good enough to just stay out of any bother, but then not bother any of the European positions?
I think you've got it spot on. I was likewise, I've really enjoyed watching them at the start of the season, just because they had a new manager, United were back in the Premiership, and you always think the two Dundee teams are absolute basket cases, but both, when they are in the Premiership, should have got an expectancy that they should be pushing for the top six or pushing rather than just trying to avoid relegation. So I was interested to see what Mellon did. I was quite enjoyed watching how well organised they were. Maybe they didn't play centre-line football, but then it just started to get bogged down. And then watching them recently, yeah, I think they're decent enough, but big concern is that watching United, just going what Tom says, Shanklin doesn't get any chances in the box. Obviously the Harkes was the one with the header. It's kind of frustrating because you're looking to see Shanklin come up and try and take the Premiership by storm. I mean, for me, Nisbet was the player who I think has more to offer. But yeah, it's like Tom, if I had the choice of the 12 Premiership teams, Dundee United would be down the bottom of the ones I would like to watch. I think Kilmarnock were the only other team I'd rather not watch.
What about Ackies? You have Ackies above Dundee United.
Yeah, I actually do. I do enjoy watching Ackies because they... sometimes they can just be disastrous. And like they were against Kilmarnock, just like I think it's sometimes fascinating to watch them how negative they were against when they got beat by Kilmarnock. But at the same time, when they I think they've got I think they've got a decent premiership spine in that Aaron Martin came back into the team. I think he's been a very good addition. Brian Easton is solid enough, and I think they bring out the best in Jamie Hamilton, so that back three is decent enough. Their problem is that they play a back five rather than they play full backs as wing backs. They need wing backs. Ross Callaghan and Hakeem Adofin, I think, do great jobs for them in the centre of the pitch. And then I actually quite like David Moyo. I think he is a good foil for someone to play alongside. It's just that they don't have a lot of quality elsewhere that would help elevate that kind of spine to be a decent team. But I find them an intriguing watch.
Excellent. I think that's us, guys, unless anybody has any other business. No, I'll take that silence as a no. So everybody, thanks again for listening. Please check us out wherever you can find us, on Twitter and Instagram and Pinterest and Tumblr and all those kind of things. Mm-hmm. And don't email us, because I don't think anybody's been in the email address for over a year or something. I'll be back later on this week with Chris Awelmo. There'll be another show on Thursday, and there'll be plenty of stuff going up on the Patreon. So just say bye, guys, and we'll get out of here.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Sports Social Podcast Network.